When we arrive, their apartment is slightly messier than usual. We glimpse their little Violette asleep in her crib. My husband and I find ourselves opposite two young parents as exhausted as they are radiant. Nicolas and Louise live in an impressive apartment that we would never be able to afford. My husband greatly envies his childhood friend, but I don't. I prefer our house. I prefer our life. Nicolas had many relationships and partners before meeting Louise. He married for the first time last year. He earns a lot of money thanks to a high-ranking finance job. He travels often and far away. He goes to see trendy plays. He dines in fancy new restaurants that we've never heard of. In a word, Nicolas is free, and that means that he lives in a modern duplex downtown while my husband lives in a bourgeois house in the suburbs. And for that, my husband still resents me a bit. Louise thanks me for the flowers. I follow her through the apartment while she searches for a vase. The first she finds is too small. I apologize, ashamed. Louise laughs and thanks me again for the very beautiful bouquet, but I think I sense a hint of irony in her voice. She places the peonies on a side table in the living room. Amid the modern and minimalist decorations, this huge pastel bouquet seems ridiculous. Louise looks sublime in her long black dress, and I can't stop myself from commenting that the color of the dress and her haircut suit her well. I'm mad at myself as soon as the words come out of my mouth. It's a habit I've been trying to correct for years. I can't help complimenting a necklace, an outfit, a lipstick, or a perfume I like. I need to settle for discreetly finding out where they come from and buying them later instead. I've always admired the women around me too much, and revealing this to them renders me insidiously inferior in comparison. I must learn to restrain myself, to do it less. Louise thanks me, but does not return the compliment. In bourgeois milieus, people rarely compliment each other. I reassure myself by methodically reminding myself of all the reasons I don't need to worry. My nails are impeccable. My hair is perfect. My outfit is elegant. I know because I only buy clothing that I've seen worn by women with irreproachable style or in unquestionably trustworthy stores. The new dress I'm wearing tonight is no exception. Black and white, silk, deceptively simple and sensible, perfectly cut, spotted this season at a cocktail party. When it comes to clothes, I prefer not to take any risks, and I pay whatever the price is without batting an eye. I breathe and gently tap two fingers on the inside of my wrist to restore my calm, a technique that a sophrologist taught me to slow my heart rate while reciting comforting mantras to myself. No one can see my neuroses except me. The way I see myself is not how other people see me. Everything is okay. I belong here. And besides, I have my beauty going for me. That I've never doubted. Objectively, I am prettier than Louise. I scrutinize her faults with a glance. I am taller and thinner than her, my features more delicate. When she moves gracefully through her large, immaculate apartment and her dress flutters with each of her movements, yes, you might think that Louise is pretty. But if you approach her to get a closer look, you notice rather quickly that her face is not as graceful, her nose above all, and that she's a few pounds overweight. That was already the case, and her pregnancy did her no favors. Her apparent beauty would not withstand a less sophisticated outfit or an apartment in the suburbs with questionable decor. Louise is not a true beauty. She pays to be pretty. That's not the case for me. My parents may not have left me anything else, but at least they had the courtesy to pass down good genes. People have been complimenting me on my appearance since I was a child. As a teenager, when I was at the mall in my working-class neighborhood with no makeup on, in jeans and an old pair of sneakers, people would do double takes. Apparently, I already resembled Nicole Kidman. Something about my eyes, people told me often. Something in my coldness, too, I imagine. Thanks to my husband, I have fine-tuned my beauty. I can now afford to make myself look the way I always wanted to, leaving my lower-class self behind. I maintained my sculpted body with yoga and tennis. I learned elegance, which in the end comes down to three things: an overpriced coat, purse, and shoes. Once this holy trinity has been achieved, the rest is easy. I know now that a lady must not place her handbag on the ground while eating on a restaurant terrace, but on her knees or on the chair next to her. I take my delicate clothing to the dry cleaner. I have my shoes polished every season. I've learned how to apply discreet but stylish makeup. One must never seem to be wearing makeup, with the exception of a crimson or burgundy lipstick. I pay to have my nails done. I go to the hairdresser every month so that my roots are never visible. Another revelation I had was that the impeccable hairstyles of the women I once so admired are not the result of a miracle, genetics, or class privilege, but are instead the natural outcome of a daily blowout that requires only two things: a professional hairdryer and the right hairbrush. And that's how I became one of those women with no runs in her tights, how I learned to match my appearance to the bourgeois house my husband and I bought. To Violette. We are clinking our champagne glasses when my husband says to Nicolas and Louise, in a complicit tone, "Welcome to real life." I don't know how to interpret this. What does my husband mean? What exactly is real life? We discuss their new status as young 40-something parents, diapers, bottles. Holding his champagne glass, my husband talks about the period when our son wasn't yet sleeping through the night and was crying for hours on end, keeping us awake and feeling powerless. He reassures Nicolas, reminding him that children grow up, that the lack of sleep, the tears, the screams don't last forever. Is that what my husband means to say when he announces so solemnly to his friends that they are entering real life? Does he mean an unexciting and overly restrictive existence? Does real life for him amount to abandoning his dreams and renouncing his freedom? So my husband is nursing a painful memory from the months that followed the birth of our son. I think again with emotion of my husband cradling him carefully, his immense hands on the baby's minuscule body, our relief when he finally fell asleep, our nervous and conspiratorial laughter the next morning, even though we had slept only a few hours ourselves. These memories with my husband are all the more precious because the three of us lived essentially in isolation during that period. We couldn't have visitors or leave our house because our son, born prematurely, had a compromised immune system. It turned out to be a blessing for our relationship. Before moving to the table, Nicolas and Louise show us the first photos of Violette, thoughtfully arranged in an album with a brief caption and a date at the bottom of each page to preserve the memory. Like Louise, I started a photo album when I met my husband, with the places and years written in pen. I never kept albums of photos of my trips or with my friends before him. My husband marks the start of when my life was worth being archived. I don't understand why anyone wouldn't breastfeed their child. It makes no sense, Louise exclaims just before we move to the table. This candor is what best characterizes her. I'm now used to it, but it still leaves me speechless sometimes. Louise says things that from someone else's mouth could be hurtful, but a profound warmth renders them inoffensive. Her smile disarms her words. I opted not to breastfeed my children, and Louise knows this. But she deems this fact of little importance, and therefore there's no reason I should take it the wrong way. She is simply stating her opinion. I remember the day when Louise said to me, "I absolutely hate the color green. It reminds me of my mother," while I was wearing a green dress, and she saw no problem with doing so. Louise is whimsical, loud, and frank, while Nicolas is elegant, restrained, and thoughtful. Tonight, they are both being precisely themselves. Nicolas is one of those people who makes the effort to step into your universe. His questions show that he's interested in my life, that he thinks of me even when we haven't seen each other for a while. He asks me how my work is going with my editor, how my classes are going, if I've read that series by a New York novelist he's just started, what I think of the translation. Nicolas is as reserved as Louise is sociable. Louise is as indelicate and brusque as Nicolas is considerate and attentive. She is radiant. He tempers her. Together, they complement each other, like two pieces of machinery that fit together exactly, a perfectly oiled gear where the deviations are also the synergies that render movement possible. I believe this is what we call chemistry. The table is quickly covered in dishes, bread, wine. The meal is excellent. I appreciate the dinner all the more because I loathe having people over. I never know what to prepare. It takes me weeks to decide. Fortunately, my husband takes charge of picking out the wine, which I am completely incapable of doing. I could buy the most expensive bottle at the wine shop, but there's a risk of seeming ridiculous. He wouldn't bring a wine that costs hundreds of euros to a casual barbecue. I've been afraid of people thinking I have bad taste ever since I realized my husband's money wouldn't buy me elegance or good manners. My hands are always visible, never on my knees. I pass dishes to the left. I wait for Louise to offer before I serve myself more fish. I let Nicolas refill my wine glass. I don't take more cheese. When the meal ends, my silverware is parallel on the plate and my napkin placed on the table, and I've taken care not to refold it. I know these rules now, but I had to make an effort to learn them. I've been practicing for 15 years. I can even perform them with a semblance of effortlessness now. When I met my husband's family, I felt that there were certain codes I hadn't mastered, but I couldn't yet identify them. One day, I witnessed a troubling scene. My husband's older sister, mother to a boy of around 10 or so, was scolding him, and I didn't grasp what he had done wrong until much later. First, there was a warning for a laugh that was slightly too loud, followed by a reprimand for his elbows being on the table. And then I heard her say, "I'm going to buy you Nadine de Rothschild's Book of Etiquette if you keep on like this." I thought it was just an expression, but soon I discovered that this manual actually existed. I bought it a few weeks later, and a parallel universe opened up to me, a world in which plates are always passed clockwise. Holding this book between my hands, I understood that there was a reason for the unease I had felt among my husband's family. It wasn't just my imagination or a lack of self-confidence. I had, in fact, committed unforgivable errors. I had taken off my shoes upon arrival. I thought I was doing the right thing. That's what my parents had always taught me. And I had served myself a second helping of chocolate as we drank coffee. This was out of gluttony. I had even mopped up my plate with a piece of bread using my hands and not my fork. I learned later that one should really refrain from mopping up their plate at all. So in a new notebook, I wrote down notes categorized thematically: dinners, gifts, posture. I promised myself that I would learn all of these rules by heart, and Nadine de Rothschild gave me the education that I had never received. During the meal, Nicolas keeps calling my husband by a childhood nickname that only Nicolas uses. This version of my husband that I don't recognize is unsettling to me. I am even more unsettled when Nicolas tells me something I didn't know about my husband. The idea that Nicolas knew him during a time when I hadn't yet met him makes me slightly dizzy. More generally, the idea that my husband existed before meeting me is surreal, even revolting. When Louise and Nicolas start to talk about their honeymoon, my entire body tenses. It's a subject I would rather avoid. Louise describes landscapes that interest me very little. Is it ever fun to look at other people's vacation photos? And in the process reminds me of a painful memory I'd rather forget. My husband had the wonderful idea to get sick during our honeymoon. How could he do this to me? I would constantly ask myself whenever I saw his pale face. A flu pinned him to the bed for 7 days straight. My husband didn't even have the originality to catch a tropical illness, a local malady with impressive symptoms, something that could have become a funny or dramatic anecdote to tell upon our return. That week, I wandered alone down the hotel hallways. I drank cocktails at the bar and let a married man flirt with me. I told my husband that I joined the hotel's hiking group to explore the island with a guide. In reality, I didn't go on any outings. What was the point of an 8-hour excursion around a volcano if my husband wasn't with me to see it? What good was it to walk along that flat blue ocean if he wasn't walking by my side? Why go to that hot, remote island if I was alone in the photos? The following Monday, my husband was finally feeling better. We went for walks on all the days that followed, and I found the island sublime, with the most beautiful landscapes I had ever seen. But still today, as soon as the topic of our honeymoon comes up, I feel a sharp bitterness toward my husband, who ruined half of that magical vacation for me. An idyllic honeymoon might have given me the strength necessary to confront the first months of our marriage. Just before dessert, we talk about my husband's birthday party 3 months ago. Finally, a topic of conversation that is a priori inoffensive. The four of us agree that the party was a success. Then my husband recounts what happened at the end of the night after Nicolas and Louise had left to go back to their baby. The electricity went out and the room was plunged into silence and darkness. The guests started to sing and then the security alarm went off due to the power outage. Fortunately, thanks to my phone flashlight, I quickly found the alarm panel, and I even guessed the code. I figured it had to be something simple, and it was 1234. My husband is a good storyteller. That might even be the main source of his charisma. He recounts stories so well that it's easy to imagine the tipsy guests surprised by the screeching alarm, my husband setting off in search of the panel, guessing the code, taking control of the situation with humor and courage. Nicolas and Louise listen. They are amused, but I am not. My husband has not once uttered my name. I am absent from his story, erased. He says I, referring only to himself, and it embarrasses me. I've analyzed enough literary texts in my life to know that it's not innocuous. It was thanks to the light on my phone that we found the panel. It was me who suggested to him that a rental space would probably choose a code that's easy to remember. It was me who tried 0000, then 1234. Why doesn't he say that? Why doesn't he say I was part of the story too? My husband concludes by thanking Nicolas and Louise for contributing to his birthday gift. In fact, he's wearing his new watch tonight. But not a word of thanks to me for having organized the surprise, sent the invitations, reserved the space, paid the security deposit, chosen the watch, washed the 50 champagne flutes at 4 in the morning. I listen to Nicolas and Louise. They say we. Their grammar is inclusive. If one of the two of them is the main character of the story, the other is never erased because of it. The other's point of view is always included in the narrative. When I told Louise the next day, she was so surprised. I also observe their way of being together. Just looking at them, you can tell there is an equal division of tasks, an equilibrium of their characters, complementary faults. He has a reassuring voice. She has a magnificent laugh. While Nicolas clears the table, Louise serves a final glass of wine. The two of them perform an impeccable choreography, a seamless lover's ballet. When Louise joins Nicolas in the kitchen, he leans toward her and kisses her on the mouth, his hand on her hip. Catching others in the act of kissing remains one of the most fascinating spectacles in the world for me. A small camera would be easy to hide in their living room. It would only take a moment while they're both in the kitchen and my husband has gone into one of the bedrooms on a phone call. I could place a tiny recording device above their TV, for example. From there, I would have a view of their sofa. I wish I could observe them once the guests leave. I'd like to see how they behave once they're finally alone. I wish I could watch their relationship from day to day. I wonder if they still seem so in love when the baby has been crying a lot, when fatigue sets in, when the worries pile up, or when one of them falls ill. Do they kiss at night on the sofa? Do they make out intensely or simply graze lips? Do they also have nights when they don't kiss with tongues? Do they touch each other nonstop, or is there space between their bodies when they watch TV? How much time do they spend talking to each other at night, and what do they talk about? Do they say they love each other every day, every week, every month? Observing them would allow me to compare their relationship with ours. I could determine whether my husband and I kiss a lot or a little, gauge the interest and depth of our daily conversations. Armed with this quantitative and qualitative data, I could thus evaluate whether our relationship is normal or cold. After dinner, as we are leaning out the windows amid cigarette smoke and the aroma of red wine, we decide to prolong the night with a game. Each player is assigned a fruit that they then have to make their team guess. My husband chooses the clementine for me. I try not to reveal just how wounded I am. Is he trying to tease me or get a rise out of me? I ask him about it in a lighthearted tone without insisting. He answers that he doesn't know why he chose this particular fruit, but that it suits me well. And then my husband stands up to serve himself more wine. Is it a coincidence, or is he avoiding confrontation? I know my husband. I know the sharpness of his gaze. I know his perceptiveness and the precision of his associations of ideas. I know the ease with which he manages to encapsulate a person in one or two phrases. I have to face facts. The man I've been married to for more than 10 years thinks of me as a clementine. For Louise, my husband chooses a pineapple. Right in front of me, he associates his best friend's wife with a summery, exotic fruit, acidic and ample. He associates her with Latin America and implies, I'm convinced, that he is intrigued by the juicy flesh of that tropical plant. So my husband thinks his best friend is married to a pineapple while he married a clementine. He lives with a winter fruit, a banal and cheap fruit, a supermarket fruit, a small, ordinary fruit that has none of the indulgence of the orange nor the originality of the grapefruit, a fruit organized into segments, practical and easy to eat, pre-cut, ready for use, proffered in its casing. Although my husband has had more to drink than I have, I refuse to drive home. I am not in a state to drive. I am much too aggrieved by the clementine incident. I want an explanation, but I am still much too distraught to confront the issue head on. Even the white lights of the city through the window cannot soothe me. I don't say a word the whole way home. We find Zoe asleep on the sofa, the TV projecting disturbing shadows onto her body. She lives in the next town over, and my husband suggests he drive her home. I refuse. I'll call you a taxi, Zoe, I reply firmly. My husband won't get out of this so easily. Evade me by driving Zoe back home so that I'll be asleep when he returns? Much too clever on his part. He's not going anywhere. He's staying with me. My husband pulls some bills out of his wallet to pay her. This sight has always moved me to an unreasonable degree, but it's not enough to extinguish my anger tonight. Then he heads up to bed. Before joining him, I take a few minutes alone to write down the main incidents that occurred this evening. His negative account of the first months with our son, his erasure of me from the story of his birthday party, and above all, the clementine. A line with the fountain pen to record his betrayal, as bitter as the supermarket fruit. I write regularly in this notebook to reflect on my experiences. It's not a diary in the proper sense. I don't go into detail. Everything can be summed up in a line or two, and then the solution to my anxiety or my anger becomes obvious. It's a funny habit that I've never told anyone about, but writing does me good. I have another notebook that I keep hidden in the same place, behind the library books. A green notebook where I copy down the ideas and advice I read in magazines, where I take notes on articles I read on the internet. I put my notebook back in its place, behind a series of encyclopedias. I am still humiliated and furious, but at least I know what to do now. Writing always shows me the solution.